Hi. Well, I guess this is Scientific Lives. I'm Dennis Overby. This is Jenna Levin from Barnard College. She's a cosmologist and the author of How the Universe Got Its Spots. You know Alan, and you know Jeremy, a.k.a. Albert. We planned a sort of a freewheeling discussion without too much in the way of presentations. Casey Cole isn't here, and Alan and Jeremy are exhausted, and I'm notoriously shy, so maybe you may all go home early, huh? So I want to start by thanking Bill for inviting me and organizing this whole thing, and my admiration for the intellectual firepower that's been sort of directed from all sides on this event, on this subject. You've really given me a lot to think about. For me, so this panel is in some ways the heart of what this conference is all about. I'm often accused, along with being a shill for the Space Telescope and a mindless follower of string theory, of writing about scientists as much as I write about science, which I think I happily admit is appropriate. I think that whatever else science is, one thing it is that it's something that people do. It's one of the richest arenas of human endeavor, with its own codes and its traditions and its personalities and its triumphs and its failures, its myths and its feuds. So I think when we get from science not just information about the universe, we hope, but also about what it means to be human. And that's sort of how I conceive of my job. And so now I'm going to insert an advertisement for my books, since they weren't mentioned. Lonely Hearts of the Cosmos, which is about a group of cosmologists who I understand now are often called the Grateful Dead of cosmology. And Einstein in Love, which is sort of about that guy. So this is a very romantic view that I have of science, but there are many problems with actually practicing it, and I'm going to toss them out, and our panelists can ignore them or whatever. One thing is, well, how do you decide who to write about? Science is an anthill, and you know, Einstein could survey all of physics, but I think the average member of a particle accelerator team these days cannot even survey a single experiment. It's just gotten all huge. So if the Space Telescope decodes dark energy, who is the hero? Is it the astronomer who got the observations? How about the person who built the camera, the James Westfalls of the world, who would go a little more unsung? Or how about the astronomers who spent 30 years of their lives trudging around corridors in Washington, going back and forth between NASA and Congress and the astronomical community to get it built? So how do you deal with that? How do you separate people out of this tangle? How do you decide where a story ends and where it starts? Who's the audience? Who reads these things? Why write a book at all? I mean, why condemn your kids to years without health insurance or your wife to not seeing you just so that some reviewer can make fun of your title? I mean, I've got a whole pages of questions, but maybe that's a start. One thing I've noticed is that people keep writing books anyway. Like they're piling up on my desk at work. And one trend I feel I've noticed in recent years, and this is purely subjective, is that there's more younger scientists writing kind of frank slice of life accounts of life in the lab or at the observatory, rather than waiting till they're 60 years old and writing some sort of tome that describes the whole field. And for me, this is very refreshing, and it's these are very interesting things to read, but I think it's also a little risky. I mean, I don't know when Watson and Crick got their Nobel, but I imagine that it was before the double helix came out. So I'm going to ask Jana, start by asking Jana how she came to write her book and whether she felt it was risky at all to kind of expose herself personally in this way. So take it away.
Well, I'm not going to assume people have read my book, so I'm just going to preface this by saying that I wrote the book as a series of letters to my mother, which in retrospect is kind of embarrassing. But it was a very personal, they were unsent letters, so it was a very personal sort of diary at the end of the day. And when I started to write that book, and in fact when I finished the book, when the book was published, I was a postdoc. I was not a famous professor. I was not Professor Emeritus who was delivering knowledge or looking over my glorious achievements. It was really nothing like that. It's like an insecure postdoc struggling to find jobs, working very hard on topics I worried might amount to nothing. And I guess when I think about questions like the one Dennis asked, why, I mean, I can turn it around to why would I write a book like that. I always have these sort of partial answers. One was that I thought it would be interesting to write about ideas that might fail. You know, a lot of books get written about all the great achievements, and there's, you know, those are great stories. There's conflict and resolution, they're great stories. But I also thought there's a lot of scientists who work their whole lives on very obscure ideas. Some of them might come to fruition, and a lot of them might not. And I felt like one of those in the latter category, especially as a postdoc. I was working on the topic of whether or not the universe is infinite. And this is a very obscure topic. It felt at the time, although I think now it's sort of less outrageous, but to ask, is there an extent to the entire cosmos, and could we ever see the shape of space or understand the shape of space or experimentally, I guess I should say observationally, determine the shape of space? And I really didn't think we could. I thought that this was a theoretical possibility, that was a very real possibility, that it made sense philosophically to imagine a universe that was created finite, but I didn't actually think we'd ever see it or measure it. And so this is, you know, this frustrating, confusing thing for me. What was I doing working on this topic that might never be observable? And I think in part I wanted to write about that experience and that conflict, but I think more and more what I've realized is it really was just the most natural way to write the book. It was the most honest, natural voice, and I had caught myself, having that kind of pseudo pre-professorial tone, in my lectures and being very, confident in presenting ideas, and I hated that tone. I hated it, and I thought it was so dishonest. And I was starting all my papers as we are forced to. In this paper, we show that. I could be the only author on the paper. I was suddenly like the royal we. And I really wanted to back away from all of that, and I realized that it was the most honest way to write the book. And by writing it to my mother, I think I was trying to find somebody I couldn't condescend to, that was, intelligent and curious, but completely terrified of mathematics and not at all interested. And I think that was really sort of the person I wanted to talk to. And was it crazy? Was it risky? It was, completely ridiculously risky, and I still, I think as long as that book's in print, it's going to be slightly embarrassing for me. I mean, I write about my breakup, with my boyfriend. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing. But but I'm glad I did it. There's no question I'm glad I did it. And I think the reason also is I never thought it would make it to print like that. I thought, I write all this stuff, I'll be free to write it. It was like jumping out of a plane. It was just this crazy, daring thing I was going to do, but it was going to be done privately. Nobody was ever going to see it. My editor was for sure going to take those bits out, And they didn't, and there it is, So I do get a lot of people coming to me and asking me what happened to the crazy, obsessive, compulsive guy who you were going out with, who couldn't get a job, who, his father was murdered, and then I have to explain we got married, and and so yes, it's a little awkward. Anybody else want to try it?
Maybe I could ask Alan. A question does occur to me. So you wrote Origins actually about the same time I was working on Lonely Hearts, which thank God I didn't know you were working on Origins, because I would have killed myself. And you took a very scholarly approach. You went around and interviewed cosmologists. Did you meet resistance from them, that this kind of...
No. I will also, like Jana, assume that you have not read this book. This is a book that I wrote around 1990. And I interviewed about 30 leading cosmologists. They were long interviews, and printed the interviews plus an introduction to the whole book. And in the interviews, I tried to get the cosmologists to talk about the personal factors that had influenced their work, their childhoods, the influences of their parents, their emotional life as well as their scientific life. Dennis asked if I had any resistance. I didn't have any resistance. I think people love to talk about themselves. And they love to think they're going to be in print. And they will even say unflattering things about themselves. I would like to say one interesting experience that I had with this book, and that is that many of these scientists would not have been willing to talk about their personal lives unless they had been framed within a discussion of their science. And so, in a sense, I use some of the science as a way to trick them into talking about their personal lives. I read the papers of the major papers of each of the scientists before I interviewed them, and got a little bit caught up on their biography so that I was able to talk to them about the details of their work. And once they began talking about their work, they were willing to let the discussion slide into other issues. One question that I saved until the very end was, do you think that the universe has a purpose? And these are all professional cosmologists. And I don't think that I would ever have been able to ask that question directly. But the way that I was able to ask it was the good fortune that Steven Weinberg, who is a leading physicist, a Nobel Prize winner, and has also worked extensively in cosmology, I think in about 1977, published a book called The First 3 Minutes, a very well-known book. And in that book, he makes this very provocative statement, the more that we understand the universe, the less it seems to have meaning. And I began my interview project 2 years later, and the way that I got to my question was, at the end of the interview, after the people are tired, I said, Steven Weinberg in his book, The First 3 Minutes, says that the more we understand the universe, the less it seems to have meaning. What do you think of that statement? And because Steven Weinberg had framed the question, I was allowed to ask it. And I got marvelous responses to this question, and different responses from everyone, and very revealing. I think that that in general, that biography is a great way to tell the story of science, for two reasons. One is that when you focus on an every kind of writing needs an organizing principle, a structure, a storyline, and just as in the New Yorker profiles, which work so beautifully, having a person there to be the focus of the story that you tell is a wonderful organizing principle, and that works in fiction and nonfiction, every kinds of writing. The other thing is that that science, as we all know, is often off-putting to a general a person of the general public. Unless they're already interested in science, many people are afraid of science. They think that it's beyond them, that they can't understand it. They might have had a bad experience in school with science. But everybody relates to human beings. And if you can tell a story about science through a life story, through the life of a human being, in which your reader will empathize with, relate to, identify with, go on a journey with a person, then through that person you can tell the story of their science. So I think biography is a really a wonderful vehicle, not certainly not the only one, but a wonderful vehicle for writing about science.
By the way, anybody wants to ask a question any time, just jump in. But just to complete the table, I was going to ask.
I don't know. Well, I don't think. You mean
do an
update?
Second edition of the Origins, because everything's changed since Dark Energy. And
well, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
It would be with a different cast of characters, of course.
Yeah, I think it would be a very useful thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Shouldn't we give Jeremy a chance to?
I thought I'd let him rest.
So let me sneak in one quick question. Alan, do you think the fact that you were a fellow scientist opened up the people you interviewed? Would perhaps a science writer or a science journalist have had a less positive reaction?
Well, I think it might have helped, but I believe that a science journalist who did their homework and let the interviewee know that they had done their homework would probably have gotten in the door also. But I think it's very important to do your homework to be able to talk about the particular papers that they have written, and then they will take you seriously, and then you can ask all kinds of questions.
The era of the singular scientist like Einstein, who is completely refashioning a physical theory, is occurring less and less now. There's so much of science now that is group-oriented. I think you mentioned earlier where you're at Fermilab and there's hundreds of scientists. So can sometimes, by focusing on one person or, you know, doing a biography, in some sense give the wrong impression to the general public of really how science is often done, and that is through collaboration and through a group process. Sometimes there isn't a singular person. How do you handle that?
Well, that's something I worry about a lot, both, well, in terms of books, but, you know, looking at the Times, because you have the ability to pluck somebody out and make them infamous. You have to, as much as possible, you have to stay true to the way it really is, and you have to let let a certain amount of complexity come into your story, and that may be actually what makes it interesting, is all these interactions, the what Peter Galison calls the trading language of these people who all know their different specialties and somehow manage to converge to do something. I mean, maybe that's the story, and you may be able to locate somebody in that. But I think it's a legitimate issue.
Isn't Rhodes' book on the atomic bomb an example where it's not specifically on one person? Is my mic not? Where, you know, there are great stories of these group efforts, and but I think that what Dennis said about the biography making it human, I think it's like anything else. Things like somebody writing a story about, you know, the typical dysfunctional family. I mean, it's that specific family, and yet it's this universal idea. And I think some of these biographies that track one person can also have that quality, that they're representing the universal theme of all the collaborators on that project. And so I guess it's really, for me, I mean, it would strike me as a difference between whether you're doing really rigid nonfiction where you're trying to do, you know, popular science to bring forward ideas, or whether you're doing something narrative or something in the form of a screenplay, for instance, or a theater play, where you're trying to hit universal themes by using a specific example.
Can I make a comment about the fact that you may have a main person in a biography does not exclude the fact that in that biography you're going to talk about how that person interacts with his colleagues. So you can easily do that. So you may have the main character, but then you have a whole cast of other people that define that character through the narrative. So I don't think it's a problem.
Yes, Sean.
Can I ask about embarrassment? Because
we have, I'm getting very comfortable with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, here's some embarrassing stories. We have in science this sort of self-imposed image of impersonality of the process of science. And even though as individuals, scientists like to see their name in print, they certainly wouldn't want their colleagues to think that they liked seeing their names in print. So I guess to Alan and Dennis, did any of your subjects after the fact have, you know, second thoughts, or did they not like the stories they saw about themselves appear? Or to Jana, did it ever come true that you were, that your colleagues questioned afterward? I mean, I wrote a graduate level textbook, and my colleague said, why did you ever do that? I can't imagine writing a more personalized narrative. So how true did it come?
Well, I guess, let me. Well, Lonely Hearts of the Cosmos is a group portrait of many people, and I didn't have very many complaints. There was one guy whose physical description he took a little bit of exception to, and I realized, and maybe that was a little bad. The main person in the book, Alan Sandage, swears that he's never read it. I'm not sure, but that's what he says. I haven't heard from Einstein.
I would say that a lot of people told me before I wrote the book not to write the book, that I should be focusing on getting a faculty job and I shouldn't be writing this book. But afterwards, you know, people sort of went right past that and they started telling me their personal stories. You know, like my wife and I divorced because my postdoc in Italy. You know, I got a lot of people's personal stories. But I remember you took exception to something I wrote. I wrote about how when we were grad students. Wait, we were grad students, and I said that after we would solve a field theory problem in Sidney Coleman's class, that we would slam chests like basketball players, and I said, you guys were too intimidated to do it, which I was sort of just, you know, making an undercurrent of a gender reference, and you go, I was not intimidated. But
yeah, I was just mad because my name didn't appear in print.
Yeah, well, I think it was originally. You
know? I think, in fact, you substituted somebody else, but okay, that's fine.
Did you want to respond to that?
No.
I think that I let the interviewees read the chapters, and if there were things that were inaccurate, I would correct them. If they were in my case, they were words that were spoken. I was not editorializing, and I think in one or two cases someone said something that they wanted eliminated, but in most cases I didn't find that to be the case. I think it's much trickier when you are writing a biography and you are characterizing someone, as Dennis did with these people, and you are using some editorial judgments. And there I think it's very important that the writer retain the authority and write it the way they see it. And you know, you might get a person to check one or two facts, but you, I think, have to maintain your authorial independence there.
Right. I held back. In many cases, some of my best lines never made it to the page because I realized it was, because you do have an enormous amount of power as an author. You are like God, and these people are at your mercy, and they really have no recourse in a way. I mean, they can complain afterwards, but what you write is out there, and everybody has to live with it. So you should err on the side of caution to some extent, I think. I think also scientists respect the fact that you are trying to do a good job, and in some ways that you are observing them the way they are trying to observe nature, and that you're, you know, if you've done your homework and you you know, there, you know, there's a bit of latitude there. Or should I ask Jeremy a question? Yeah, Jeremy, so you've gone from Tennessee Williams to Einstein. So was, is there a difference in, like, you know, what, you know, in terms of approaching these two characters? Was it?
Well, the Tennessee piece is word for word Tennessee Williams. I mean, and it's direct address. And to the audience, and when Bill and company asked me to do this, I said, one, I'm not going to do direct address ever again. It's very hard. And two, I wanted it to be fictional. I wanted there to be a strong fictional element so that I wasn't up here, quote unquote, impersonating Einstein. And I wanted there to be a fourth wall, and I wanted to write a play. And the Williams piece has a very definite structure to it, but it's Tennessee talking. It has a beginning, middle, and end, but it's not really about, there's nothing happens in the evening. In this evening, I hope something happens.
There's a lot has happened already.
Yeah. So, I mean, with the Tennessee, I had his words, and I was going to only use his words. And in this piece, we had the rights to use some of his quotations, and you know, that's all very fine and well, but I needed to find some way in. I mean, you know, I mean, I knew very little when I began. I read a lot of books, and Dennis, your book was terribly helpful. Alan Einstein's Dream was very helpful in terms of getting, both books moved me. I thought, oh, well, if there's something here that moves me besides all of the science and the great man and the science, you know. I mean, I started reading Einstein, you know, that Einstein's autobiography. Uh-huh. I could, you know, could not get through that. And I thought, I'm just in terrible trouble here. And I found a few elements that I began to hook into. I made a couple of choices, and you know, when I had a deadline,
that always helps.
I had a deadline, and I just sat down and did it. You know, I mean, I kind of like Rebecca was saying she couldn't remember that she'd written it. And I think that I was pretending that I wasn't writing it because I didn't want to admit that I was writing a play about Einstein. I had a lot more quotations in it in the beginning, but then I realized, and I wrote this whole first part of it that was not, and there are no quotes in the very beginning of the piece, and it's all of a sudden I said, oh, well, I can write, I have an Einstein that I can write. That was just a tremendous liberation for me. And as I've been rewriting it, I've been replacing the quotes, except for the ones that I think are really wonderful and important. And it's, you know, of course, they're quotes of his, but I mean, they're not in German, so it's not what he said anyway. So, you know, it's... And with the Williams piece, it's all verisimilitude. It's all about coming on stage and convincing the audience that you are Tennessee Williams and that you're talking to them as Tennessee Williams. And that piece used to have an intermission to it. And someone said, you know, people said to me, get rid of the intermission because we get used to you as Tennessee. And then you tell us to go out and have a drink. And then you go, so where do you go? You go backstage and then you come back out and then we have to begin to believe that you're Tennessee again. And that's a really huge responsibility, and it's a, I'm going on too long, but I'll just simply say that I've gotten, you know, people say that I impersonate Tennessee and blah, blah, this and blah, blah, blah. And I don't impersonate Tennessee. I'm an actor, you know. I just act what I think. I act from my heart, Tennessee Williams, through his words. And that it is so close to him, it's just simple kind of confluence of my looks and my temperament and his. And with the Einstein, I wanted it to be very clear that from the very beginning that this is a fiction. That's why I put that silly Pirandellian thing in the very beginning about this actor who wants to look like him, who thinks he has a right to buy him. So they're two very different pieces to me.
More questions?
Yes.
Brian.
Lucero plays a role in your play. How did you decide to put that in, and then where did you decide upon that relationship? Because it's very hard to find his relationship with him in anything that's really written or documented.
Say what? Oh, Lucero?
Yeah.
Well, Lucero was key to me to create a fiction. And you've seen it, so you have coming attractions. I wanted a fiction. I thought I read somewhere about yet another imposter that came forth, but I can't find it in any of the books. So maybe I dreamed it, and it just was an ideal. It was an ideal for me, fictional element to bring into the piece as a launching pad something that nobody could contest. We were talking about, you know, you want to have something that nobody really knows anything about, that you can, you know, feel free to create with your own imagination. And as this Einstein is a fiction, I mean, this Einstein, you know, everyone has their own opinion about who Einstein was, and, you know.
But it's entirely plausible that there could be more imposters. I mean, there are so many shadows around
right.
Einstein's life that way.
So, I mean, that was the key for me, is that I wanted to have a fictional element, and this was it.
Very sympathetic with her, and I mean, that would be the noble thing to do.
There is a letter that he says he loved her before he knew her. I quoted in the second act, and I mean, that's all I need. That's the only excuse I need. I mean, I'm not saying that he did or that he was obsessed that these imposters would show up again, but as I said, I think I must have dreamed it now that this was like part of what was going on in him. But for me, it's what's going on in my Einstein. It may not be true at all.
I think that he was probably on the lookout his whole life for somebody who might claim to be her.
He and Helen and I can't remember the other guy made every effort to cover up his personal life, at least until the time he died, and even for some many years after that.
Long after he died.
Yeah. The story about the papers being packed up in the middle of the night and sent to Jerusalem, I mean, it's really unbelievable. So he was very careful.
Could I just ask, you're all writing, even Jeremy's writing a biography in a sense. I'm interested in the degree to which the personality is the real focus rather than the science. Could you comment on that? I'm afraid I don't know your writing quite clearly. With you, it was the first person. But do you feel that science was your primary focus, or was it, in a sense, expressing yourself?
Well, for that book, science was the primary focus. I mean, I really wanted those ideas to live on, even if they weren't going to be observable things that were going to hit and become, you know, really popular ideas. I think since then they have, you know, there were a lot of people who worked on the idea of a finite universe or the possibility, and it's much more kind of conventional now. Even people talk about it when they give the standard talk on looking at the universe and its properties to ask whether or not it might not be finite. I mean, so that sort of survived, but that was the primary focus for sure. And if you were literally to divvy up which bits were personal versus how much was, you know, straightforward kind of pedagogy description of how to even imagine visualizing three-dimensional spaces that wrap back onto themselves and that sort of thing, it's clearly really heavy on the science in that sense. But I think since then I've been writing other things where I'm less interested in doing pedagogical kind of popular science. I'm really much less interested in it, and in a way I sort of felt I kind of had to do that. I could now imagine rewriting that whole book and leaving most of it out. You know, I did a review of special relativity, I talked about general relativity, and I think that right now I don't feel that I have to do that. I don't feel I have to, you know, go through the whole history of science to really have people come away with tools that they can actually functionally use. That's not as necessary for me as just giving somebody, you know, it's like taking a picture from the top of Mount Everest. You just want to show them, you know, a glimpse. You have to give them every detail of the tools you use on the climb. And even in that first book, I was very sparse. You know, it's very short. I don't do very detailed stuff. I did think that I was doing just giving a view, but I think more and more now, my emphasis is getting on the story, whether that means the person, the biography, or if the story is in the science, that's good too. I think I'm sort of more interested in that kind of narrative structure right now. I don't know if that answers your question.
I was not drawn to Einstein originally by the science. I was really drawn in by the discovery of his love letters to Mileva and the idea of recreating the young man. Not just the scientist, but the whole person in all his dimensions, which had been basically missing from our folklore for the last 50 years. As I got in, the project turned out to be much bigger than I thought it was going to be. And in some ways, the love letters and that aspect of it, in some ways, kind of turned out to be a kind of MacGuffin. MacGuffin. Because I got tired of the love letters and the waves of women and after a while I just didn't want to read any more of them, and as I was editing the book I was just slashing them out and shortening the quotations, and what really finally pulled me through the book, I think one was like, well, I mean, the drama of general relativity is really amazing, and it's not, and I don't know of any attempts really at a good of explaining it on a popular level, and I'm not happy with mine either. And the other thing is Einstein's involvement with quantum theory in the early years, which is always overlooked because of relativity, but it is extremely important, I think.
I'm interested in continuing the discussion of, Jeremy and I write fiction about scientists and science, as does Penny and a couple of other people here, Sid. And I'm interested in bringing up the question again about factual accuracy in fiction. And maybe a good question would be, Jen, if your book was turned into a play, how would you feel about the author taking artistic license with your life, as a way of discussing. as a way of discussing what Einstein would think about Jeremy's performance. And I was actually lucky enough to meet one of the central characters in one of my plays. It was about his life, and he actually, I saw him watch the play about himself, and it was, he said to me, I like the play, but I don't ever want to see it again. so it's an interesting question, and it would be something that, using Dennis's book, I used a lot of his for research for some of my plays, and Alan's book as well. And it's just interesting to bring that out there since y'all have the biography perspective.
Well, Alan, you write fiction about scientists also, especially Good Benito. Well,
It depends on whether you name the person in the book. If you name the person, and so the reader knows who you're talking about, then I think there's a literary problem, which has nothing to do with ethical considerations, and that is that if the reader or the viewer knows that you're writing about an historical character, then they are going to bring a lot of baggage to the reading or the viewing, and you can't ignore that, and so you have to deal with that in some way or another. And so I would say that instead of worrying about whether you get everything accurate or not, that the first concern is this artistic work. How do you deal with the fact that there's already an elephant in the room when you start off? So that's what I would face. The books that I've written, my fiction, I haven't had real scientists in them, except for Einstein's Dreams. And in Einstein's Dreams, I used historical accuracy in the waking moments for Einstein, but then I felt totally free to do whatever I wanted in the dream worlds. That's what I worry about in using historical figures, is just to deal with what the reader already has in their minds.
Am I jumping on your heels?
No, I'm finished.
As far as the portraying the science, I mean, I don't feel that I need to see completely comprehensive expositions of science and things like plays in order to move people. I think sometimes it's very effective just to have, again, that, you know, just that glimpse and get a feeling for it. So I like anything that's said to be accurate, I think, is my feeling when I'm seeing something. That would be true outside of my discipline, too, if I see a play on, I don't know, consciousness, or I like those points to be accurate, because what I walk away with, I want to trust. You know, I want to like preserve it. I want to have a relationship with that thing that I walk away with and feel good about it. But it doesn't have to be comprehensive at all. And I really agree with Alan that the historical issue is tricky. I mean, I've been trying that lately. I've been writing about real historical characters, and some things have changed. And I know that it's more important to me that it, you know, it work as a piece of writing than that it be historically accurate, for sure. And I don't know if that's an immoral choice that I'm making. I just know that, you know, that's how I feel about it, absolutely. I think that question kind of came up earlier in one of the earlier panels about fact bending. It seems to me that most people have all said the same thing, preserve the quality of the work. If it's fiction, yeah. For sure. Right, for sure. Right, if it's nonfiction, you shouldn't be doing that.
One thing that's interesting, this has nothing to do with science, but it has to do with actually literal representation of a person on stage. So that I have my one-man show of Tennessee Williams, and then I also did Tennessee Williams in this piece called 5x10. And it's been very interesting to me that while I get many of the similar reactions about my accuracy of Tennessee or blah, 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 that I feel that there's a very different person created in 5x10 than there is in the other, and yet it's the same actor, and sometimes it's similar words, but it's the selection, it's the context in which it happens, and it's very odd to me that sometimes I feel I'm playing two different people, even though I'm playing exactly the same person, exactly the same way that I feel, but that just in a different context, a different selection of the words, the person himself seems to be a different person.
You are Einstein and Steve Martin Einstein.
Right, exactly. Yes.
Jenna, as you know, one of the things that I really admired about your book was that it combines cosmology and autobiography, and sometimes with abrupt juxtapositions of going from a cosmic view to an extremely personal view. And so reading it, for me, was naturally a situation of thinking about being in cosmos. Did you have existential thoughts as you wrote this book, or is it just my reading?
No, I think anybody, and you know, they know that there's a few people here who work in theoretical physics, has existential thoughts, no? Will you guys nod at least, or say so? Yeah, absolutely, and I think I didn't want to iron out really sharp jump sometimes, because I think a lot, you know, the book's very melancholy. I don't know why it's so melancholy, but I really think it is. And you know, I'm not a glum person, and yet I see it there a lot. I think there was a really strong feeling of being disconnected because of my work, being disconnected from other things. You know, I wasn't this person who spent their whole childhood lost in chemistry sets, who was more comfortable away from, that really wasn't me at all. And yet here I was in this whole mental sphere where I couldn't communicate with people. I was traveling around, traveling the world. And so, yeah, I mean, that alienation is part of the research and is part of the lifestyle, just part of the culture of physics. And so I didn't want to smooth that out and pretend that it was perfectly natural to be a human being doing theoretical physics. It's not natural, and the jumps are very awkward, and there are moments where it doesn't fit together, where you're talking about, you know, science, and you've lost the person you're talking to. And you still keep going, you still keep plowing, you know, and then come back to the personal again. So I didn't try to make it this perfectly balanced little melody. I don't know if that answers your question. Your question was more about the existential. Ask it again.
I'll ask it to there tomorrow. What about the what you refer to as the imprint of a cosmic code in us? Is that something that you still believe?
Yeah, I do.
That relates to existential. So.
Yeah, I do still believe that. I mean, I don't know. I don't think it's that contentious a thing to say. But I think, you know, our vision is peaked around the yellow. It just accidentally happens that the sun emits primarily in the, you know, yellow in the visible wave band. I mean, these aren't accidents. We evolve under the laws of physics, and I think that our brains evolved according to mathematical rules and laws of physics. And if it's there, nested in the logic of the structure of the synaptic endings, that shouldn't be, you know, a huge mystery. Our synaptic, you know, our axons and all those things in our brain work according to electromagnetic phenomena and chemical phenomena. So if, you know, our logical structure works that way too, I feel that's a natural inheritance from being part of the cosmos. We didn't just precipitate out of nowhere. And I love that. I mean, I find that very moving. And again, that's something that I'm really interested in right now, is this idea that, you know, scientists see the world in this cold and barren way. I think it's totally untrue. And scientists may have trouble expressing that, may try to remove themselves from their work all the time, but I think the reality is most scientists feel so integrated in the cosmos by these realizations that it gives them a real feeling of belonging and purpose and meaning. And I definitely feel that those things drive me to keep going, even when it would be easier to do something else.
I'd like to ask one more question of the panel, and that is, what is, since we're dealing a lot with writing styles and means of representation, how does genre, for lack of a better word, affect the portrayal of a life? That is, Dennis, I interpret what you're saying as you might represent something different in the New York Times than you would in a book. Jana writes in a diary format in that book. Sometimes you're writing biographically, establishing portraits of people. Sometimes you're writing intimately about yourself. Does the form change the portrayal, and how?
Well, from the New York Times, it's 1,200 words versus 120,000 words, and a few hours or a few weeks to 5 years makes a big difference. And also, well, maybe I'll get into some of this tomorrow, but certainly when you're writing a book, you have more freedom stylistically. For example, I am a character in Lonely Hearts of the Cosmos. I was very frustrated because I could not make myself a character in Einstein in Love. And I tried to on some parts, and my editor took it out and said it didn't work. And partly because I use myself as an organizing principle, but I think that's an interesting issue. When you write nonfiction, you have to admit someplace along the line that you're not God, that what you're doing is arbitrary and subjective. You've decided the story starts here and it ends there, and these are the people that are in it, and this is what you know, but there's a lot you don't know, and so, and how do you knit all this together? And so you can be freer than you can, I think, in a, like a formal biography, which actually I don't like biography very much, but it is restricted by gazillions of footnotes and lots of other stuff. And the New York Times is a whole other story altogether.
But you're not allowed to talk about when it's being filmed, right?
Which?
The New York Times.
No, no, we can talk. We can talk about the New York Times. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that tomorrow, because that's another part of the food chain.
If I can also ask Alan this in a similar, just to extend your question, because I think Einstein's dreams, writing a work of fiction like that, which must have been pretty daring for you too at the time that you did it. And do you have any, I don't know, recollections about that or feelings about how you made that transition to fiction?
Well, I didn't think of it as being daring. I just thought of it as something that I've had to do. And I think that every creative person here in the room, and I think we all are, knows what it's like when you're bitten by an idea or an impulse and you just go with it. And so you don't have the question of saying no to it when it grabs you. So you don't think about whether you're being daring or whether you're going to succeed or not. You just have to do it. You can reflect back later on and say, God, I was taking a big risk, but you don't think about that at the time.
Mm-hmm. Marcella?
It's similar to the other question, but it's for both of you, so now you're on the spot as well. It seems to me that, well, Alan made a transition from nonfiction to fiction. We talked a little bit about it before, and you seem to be making this transition as well. And the question is, what drives you? I mean, what's doing this? Is it because you feel like the non-fictional format is sort of exhausted for you, for the way to express what you want to say about yourself and the world? Or so it's I'm going through the same process, but I want to hear from you guys, see if I can learn something.
You first.
Well, that's a great question about what the difference is between non-fiction and fiction, and I think there are many differences, and I don't understand all of them. But I can just speak about one difference and one factor for me personally, and that is that I think that fiction is a better vehicle for exploring emotional truth. Not that you can't have emotional and psychological elements in nonfiction, but I think that the most powerful vehicle for exploring emotional and psychological truth is through fiction. That the whole name of the game in fiction, I believe, is for inviting your reader to be part of the creative experience, to get into their stomachs and their hearts first, and to really get them into the scene and have them be emotionally affected. And I think that that has a tremendous power. And that's what fiction is really good at. I think playwriting and plays do that too. And that doesn't mean you can't deal with ideas in plays or ideas in fiction, but you come to the ideas, I think, later, and you first go for the stomach or the heart.
I was going to say that ultimately in nonfiction you are constrained by what actually happened. And this can be terrible. I mean, you may miss a plot point, or something is never resolved, because, and unless you make it up, you're just going to have to leave it like that. So That's all I wanted to say.
Well, I really have struggled with this fiction, nonfiction thing. I'm not a big reader of nonfiction. I'm a big reader of fiction. I read a lot of fiction. And I think I'm very overwhelmed by really beautiful writing. It affects me permanently. I carry it around. I think about it for a long time. And I think Alan's absolutely right. It's because you get some truth from it that's just unbelievable. And it might just be the turn of phrase. It's something that people can do in fiction that you don't see done in nonfiction quite as often, although it happens. And so I think I wanted to try to see, you know, how far you could go with just going after this other form of truth without being constrained by actual, you know, not just fact, and not just talking about fact and fact bending, but completeness. If you're going to write something in nonfiction, you're kind of forced to, you know, out of fairness, account for lots of alternative perspectives or digressions or things that need to be accounted for, and you kind of lose the essence of some other true statement that I felt maybe I was after. And so by going to fiction and making that the whole, you know, point, I felt I'd maybe get more out. But it's still an experiment, you know. I don't know, you'll have to read my next book and tell
me. I think you're always experimenting when you're writing fiction.
I love the experience of doing the writing. You know, there's not a moment where I have to do something tedious, like oh, now I have to get through the part about how things scatter for the last time, or you know, or something like that. I don't owe anybody this kind of markers, and so I'm loving, you know, so I'm enveloped in it, and your hope is that it comes across, and other people will be enveloped in it also.
Is your nonfiction, is your fiction in a scientific setting?
Yeah, it is sort of. I don't have a title or anything. I don't have a one-liner. I think you don't know, your book's not done until you have that one-liner. It took me a long time to say, like, my first book is about whether or not the universe is finite. I mean, I had my one-liner. It took me about halfway through that book. This one I'm almost completely done with, and I still don't have my one-liner. I think it's about two people who were talking about truth literally and the structure of logic, and yet diverge completely in their faiths and beliefs. You know, one believed in transmigration of the soul, and the other became a materialist from being, that's Kurt Gödel and Alan Turing. These are real people who became a complete materialist, and I think it's about, you know, this trend.
It's about the finiteness of the soul.
There you go. Uh-huh. It sounded a little much coming from me.
I've got a question for Alan. Do you believe that mind preceded matter? And if so, why? And if not, why? And you might do this autobiographically and second. And you might want to rephrase this question. Did you find all the cosmologists that you interviewed as foolish as Professor Weinberg? And you're free to rephrase that one. Mind before matter.
So did mind precede matter?
Do you believe that mind,
well,
mind preceded matter?
Is that the same as asking whether there was a prime mover?
I suppose it would be, yes.
Well, I'm going to just bite the bullet on that one and say that I don't believe that there was a prime mover. I realize that's a very personal belief, but I think that there is tremendous beauty in the laws of nature, and I think that's kind of what what this character believed as well, that Einstein's God was, if you look at everything that he said about God, you realize that it was not a God, the same God that most religions hold as a God, that it was really the totality of the laws of nature. The question about Weinberg's foolishness, I think it was a very bold statement for Weinberg to make, and it certainly is a good lightning rod to drop a lot of reaction. I seriously doubt whether Weinberg meant that statement as baldly as it sounds. I think that if you asked him really about the meaning
the purpose of the universe, and he talked at length about it, that he would have a much more complex answer that would involve the laws of nature. He's a great believer in the power of symmetry principles, and in fact believes that you can derive all of the forces and particles of the universe from ideas of symmetry, and that to me is a gorgeous idea. I would, my own opinion as someone who believes so zealously in symmetry as Einstein does, other people would interpret that as some kind of meaning in the universe, if the meaning is symmetry.
Back there.
Yeah, I think when Weinberg is talking like that, he's really talking about art. And when
talking about what?
Art.
Art.
You know, and that whole idea that art doesn't mean it is, which is always so difficult and so contentious, even for artists. But I think it's exactly the same debate that's running, because if you keep trying to give it a purpose, give it a meaning other than itself, then you displace it in some way.
I think the last time I heard Weinberg discourse about this, he said that it was humans that gave meaning to the universe. That's for us to decide what we want to value. Any more questions?
We've exhausted them.
I guess. Thanks.